Accession number 29234, reel number 1.
This is Jill Monk, reel 1. And if I could ask you first of all, Mrs. Monk, to tell me something of your life before the war started, where you were born and brought up, and the sort of family life you had.
Well, I was born in Aylsham, just. My father came up from Devon to do a locum for the doctor who was ill, and he came in December 1935, and the doctor was still ill when January came. He stayed on for another month, and during that time he died. And his widow and daughter asked my father to take over if he would like to take over the practice, which of course in those days came at quite a price, because he had to buy the practice, he had to buy a house, he had to buy a surgery, and as he'd come out of the Navy at the end of the 1418 war with just a set of instruments, it was quite a job to find the money. Anyway, he got things sorted out, and Mum followed at the beginning of February. I was due at the end of February, and travelling up by train with a maiden lady friend who was terrified that she might produce the baby on the way. Anyway, luckily I hung on till the end of March, so all was well. My mother had planned a son, not a girl, so the monthly nurse christened me in the end, finding out that I was going to be William, called Bill. So she said, "Oh, well, why not call her Jill?" So Mum said, "Well, anything you like." You know, she was so disappointed. I had an elder brother and sister. Brother was 7 years older and sister was 5 years older, and never saw much of my brother really, because he was at boarding school when he was seven, and he and my sister very much hunted as a pair and didn't want me tagging along, being a nuisance, slowing them down in whatever they were doing. And when I'd learnt to ride a bicycle and want to follow them, of course, they wouldn't wait for me, so I was always coming off my bike and cutting my knees and cutting my elbows and being an absolute pain to them. I went off to boarding school at seven. It was an experiment at the boarding school I went to. They'd previously only taken children of 10. And I and another younger sister were taken there to see how they managed with younger ones. Didn't like it very much, and I don't think it liked me very much. But I think we'll gloss over that one. I remember we used to go down to Devon to a cottage on the southern edge of Dartmoor for August, which was Dad's holiday. He had the month off, and that was the only time he had off during the year. And he and my brother and sister used to fish. They managed to hire an old pony from a farmer nearby, and I and the doctor's daughter from the sanatorium nearby used to disappear on our ponies and cause a certain amount of consternation at times when we didn't turn up when we should have done. But it was a great life. And I remember that last holiday, the war clouds on looming, you know, and talk of war. And it suddenly, I was due to go to school in Switzerland because my mother had been ill with a... After an accident, she got gangrene in her leg, and she eventually lost the leg below the knee. And they had decided that because I was asthmatic and violent hay fever, that it'd be a good idea for me to go to school in Switzerland. And, of course, I was in a panic because when I said, what's going to happen to me if there's a war, they said, well, you know, you'll stay there. We shan't be able to get you home. You'll just have to stay in Switzerland. Previously, I was only going to come home for the summer holidays. And as we'd just got my pony up from Devon, I didn't like not having a pony the rest of the year. So anyway, of course, the asthma got much worse with worry. So eventually, my father decided that I'd have to stay at school in this country. And he remembered that his sisters had all been at Cheltenham Ladies' College, and he thought, well, he might manage to sort of push me in on the strength of that as a last-minute sort of entry. Luckily, of course, several girls had left to go to America for safekeeping, so Cheltenham decided they'd take me in. So I had 3 years there.
And that was from 1939?
Yes.
1939.
Travelling was a bit hectic because every now and then a bomb landed on the railway line and the trains didn't run and I was late getting back. So I decided to try going via Birmingham instead of London. But of course, the first time I did that, there was first air raid on Birmingham. So there I was in the station, stuck there all night, and eventually got away for the next mid-morning. I think I had to change Gloucester or Cheltenham, I forget which. Gloucester, that was it for Cheltenham. Anyway, I got back to school eventually.
How did you settle at Cheltenham?
Well, quite reasonably well, actually, although I was such an outdoor girl, which was what hadn't suited me at the prep school. I had a very, very understanding housemistress who realised, you know, how thoroughly undisciplined I was. And she used to send me off to walk her boxer dog. Every spare moment, I used to take him off Firdle. I used to take Firdle for walks. And I think it was due to her, really, that I did settle there, because the discipline was very strict there, but it was very fair. One could see the reason for it. The last term, I didn't get back. There was no transport to get me back for about a fortnight. And they really thought, well, I was busy working on local farms. And, you know, they came to the conclusion that one didn't know what was going to happen with the war, and I was better off doing that than getting back to school late and trying to cope with school cert. So I didn't go back at all.
So you would have left at the age of about 15, would you?
16.
16,
yes.
Could I ask you now about your involvement with the auxiliaries? And perhaps first of all to ask you about your father and how he became involved.
Well, of course, when the Home Guard started in the town, I think my godmother's husband was one of the prime movers, and also another gentleman who's we used to share the Devon cottage with. And Dad, they were sort of three prime movers in the town, really, because it was quite a small town in those days. And they sort of had their LDV armlet. And I don't know, I think Dad had a 12-bore. Well, I think the three of them had a 12-bore. And, of course, the Home Guard gradually evolved, and Dad had Home Guard uniform. He was a major, I think, because he was battalion MO, and he used to disappear in the evenings to ostensibly do first aid lectures. Anyway, we were a bit surprised that whenever they had a parade in the town, that Dad would never parade in uniform. He always went in civvies. And it wasn't until long after the war that I realised, you know, that it was because he was in the Home Guard uniform was just a cover. Of course, a doctor was in a very good position if there was an invasion, because he would obviously be given a permit and petrol to visit his patients, and he could cope an eye lifting for troop movements, places that were likely places to bomb or put out of action in some way, like railway stations and post offices and banks, that sort of thing. And the next thing was, we had a television transmitter and receiver put in the air raid shelter in the garden underneath the floorboards. Well, that was in full view of the front gate, and although there were, it was a very quiet road then, and very little traffic, it was thought that it was too vulnerable for people walking past to wonder why we were rushing down into the air raid shelter when there wasn't an air raid.
It was under the floorboards of the air raid shelter,
yes.
Was it?
Yes, there were duckboards on the floor, and they put a metal cover under the duckboards and then a sort of metal box for the transmitter. Anyway, we also had a gardener who was, I think he had tuberculosis, and he used to sort of work part-time in the garden when he felt well enough. Well, of course, he got suspicious about what was going on in the air raid shelter, so he had to be brought in and sign the Official Secrets Act. And then they had the brilliant idea of putting the wireless set in the cellar under the house. It had been a coal cellar, and there was a coal chute from outside for them to tip the coal. It went down the chute into the cellar. So they blocked off the opening and made it look like the rest of the paving of the backyard. And in the place where the coal used to go down, they fitted the transmitter, and the cellar was made to look like an air raid shelter for the poor Brits frightened of the German bombing, you know. It was cleaned up considerably, and the spiders were removed, and it was lime washed, a few chairs, one thing another. And in front of the transmitter and receiver, they fitted an asbestos sheet with an electric stove on it. And on the right-hand side, there was a little narrow place where you could fit a very thin knife to lift a catch, which would release the asbestos sheet and with the stove on it, lift that out, and there was the transmitter behind it. The aerial was very cleverly led up at nearby chimney, very high up, and rather, you know, a chimney that you didn't really notice a lot. And the aerial was on there, looking like a lightning conductor. And we had sheets of cipher papers to copy out when we sent messages through. And neither my sister nor I could remember how often the codes changed. I had a feeling that there were sheets for each day and they were changed. We had a fresh set every month. Somebody else said they thought it was every week, but we've never been able to remember which it was, you know.
But they were changed, were they?
They were definitely, oh yes, they were changed quite reasonably frequently. Of course, you know, it had become impossible for us not to know anything, so my sister was married and she was away at the time with her husband, but my mother and I had to sign the Official Secrets Act and, you know, we were taken in. I was spending spare time breaking in horses for people because there was nobody else to do it. And I had this sort of affinity with horses. I seemed to be able to, you know, do more or less anything with them. The only problem being, of course, when they went back to their owners, they didn't behave as well as they should have done. But, of course, doing that, you know, just a girl, and after all, in those days, we were very unsophisticated. I was able to keep an eye lifting for troop movements and, again, anything that might be worth bombing. And, of course, nobody, you know, would be likely to, was thought not likely to suspect a 15-year-old riding around on a horse. And I could get through the woods and along the fields and that sort of thing where troops were often camouflaged. And that would all go back as a practice for if, you know, there was an actual alert.
And so when you say it would go back, you would actually send a message?
It would be sent through, yes.
Would you do it yourself?
Generally speaking, either mum or dad did them. It was sort of in their hands, really.
And that would be in one of these codes, would it?
Yes, yes. All had to be coded. We never knew where it went to, of course. We never knew anybody else who was functioning on this. I never knew who recruited my father for it. I just don't know whether the military approached him. I never knew. It was all very hush-hush because if we didn't know anything, we couldn't, in the event of an emergency, we couldn't tell. I mean, they could torture us as hard as they liked, but there was nothing we could tell.
That's an interesting point, is it? Because I suppose, had there been an invasion, you would have been arrested as a spy, would you not?
Yes. If they found our set. But the interesting thing I only learned quite recently was that the way the set was constructed, it, as far as I'm not very understanding about these things, but I think it worked on two wavelengths. And unless they could find the two wavelengths, the Germans would never discover it. And I think they have managed to reconstruct one, because at the end of the war, or when the auxiliaries were stood down, the whole lot were collected up and dumped down a coal mine. They never kept one for history. And there was one gentleman left who had been in the making of them, and he eventually managed to help the scientists at one or other of the universities to reconstruct one of these sets. And I presume it's, you know, it's still as impossible to find as it was then. But it was a very clever system, because any time anybody's asked me about it, I said, well, of course the Germans would have got onto your set in a minute when you were transmitting. And I said, well, there was some reason why they couldn't. And then it was very recently that John Warwicker told me roughly how it was done. Every now and again the soldiers came and changed the batteries, and they used to get a cheese and a soup and cheese lunch, which made our place fairly popular.
Would that have been caused suspicion with your neighbours, soldiers
well,
coming?
Well, you see, the house was very isolated. I mean, here we've got houses fairly close, but in those days we were surrounded by fields, and it was a very quiet road. There was one farm about half a mile past, but most of the traffic went to that along this road. So there was, you know, they wouldn't really have realised, and there were troops messing about. There were troops in the town, billeted in various places, so anybody seeing a couple of soldiers driving into our place would probably think they were billeted with us. So, you know, it was much easier.
So really it was your father, your mother and yourself,
yes,
involved in this,
yes,
as a little team,
yes,
as it were, a nucleus of this.
Yes. Yes.
Who was Mr. Collings?
Oh, John Major Collings, yes, is subsequently Colonel Collings. He was the coordinator for the area, and he had to go around visiting and making sure that everything was working okay and that, you know, we were au fait with any of the latest information. And, of course, he was in the Inniskilling Dragoon Guards. And I rather gathered that pre-war there was a polo team which functioned in Germany. Mad Englishmen playing polo, you know. And of course they were all with their eyes open seeing what was going on with Germany rearming. He had a lovely Alsatian called Mark, who was a very famous dog, actually. He was a Belgian police dog who, by certain underhand means, came into John's ownership. And he was beautifully trained, and I had him for a while to look after when John was supposed to be going on a course. And I had him for many weeks. Supposed to have him for 6 weeks, but he was with me for a lot longer. And I was told I wasn't to let him get into the car before I got in, because otherwise he wouldn't let me in. I think that lasted about 48 hours, and he was as good as gold. He let me in. I had to be introduced to him. And, you know, he was told, now this is your mistress, you guard her, and you do as she tells you. And he went everywhere with me. I was sleeping in a downstairs room at the time, and there was a spare bed which Mark slept on, until one wet night my mother came to, when I had flu, my mother came to take him out for a last pee, and it was a very wet night. It was pouring with rain, and Mark took one look at it and said, no, I'm not going out. And so he came back, and he got on my bed, which was alongside the wall, and he got between me and the wall, and he wasn't going to move, and Mum went to get him by the scruff of the neck and say, come on out. And he grabbed her and snarled, you know, and drove her off. And I slapped him hard, and I said, you wicked dog, go on out for a walk. And he looked at me, and he sort of shrank into his skin, so to speak, and crawled off the bed and went outside into the drive and came galloping back very quickly. He was amazing, because one time I was riding into the woods, and there was a whole collection of military vehicles camouflaged in the woods, and a couple of soldiers came along and sort of, you know, were chatting, wanting to chat me up. And I decided I needed to get away. So one of them got hold of the horse and said, "Oh, you don't need to go yet." I said, "I do." And I said, "Mark, we'll make you let go of that horse." So, "Mark, who's Mark?" I said, "You'll find out." I said, "Mark, attack." And Mark went for them, roaring at them. They let go in a hurry. And funnily enough, they were John's regiment. So I never knew whether they knew him, but I imagine he'd been seconded onto this work, you know, as soon as he came into the country after the German episode.
Yes, I could imagine you were at risk, you know, going in woods with troops.
And yes.
Particularly sort of camouflaged places.
Yes, yes.
An attractive young girl on a horse.
Oh, yes, it was quite fun, but the horse was very useful to get out of the way. I had the old black fellow, and I also had an Arab stallion, a chestnut, that I used for most of my spying work in the daytime because he, you know, he didn't show up so much as a black horse.
Was it mainly in the daytime that you went, that you did your
yes,
spying?
When we had exercises, we were out at night, but that was principally for message carrying. But at one point I was nearly rumbled when I was carrying a message at night, about 2 o'clock in the morning. A man came and I was hiding under some rhododendrons, and a man came up and leant against a tree and lit up his pipe. And if you can imagine, you want to sneeze, you want to cough, you know. And because I didn't know who he was, you see, they said that there would be people out to try and catch us. And I didn't know whether he was one of the people who was out to catch us, or whether he was a gamekeeper, whether he was a poacher. I couldn't see him. I could just smell the tobacco. Anyway, eventually he knocked his pipe out and went off. And I'm afraid I didn't spend any more time trying to find where to put the message. Because the messages were put into a pipe. They were put in a tennis ball that was split open, and the message was stuffed into the tennis ball. And then they ran down this pipe to the operations room, wherever it was, down underground.
Would you have known where they were, the operations
room? No, you knew where the drop place was, but that was all. Anyway, after that they decided perhaps, well, I think Dad's behest really, they decided that night work wasn't the thing. Although knowing the area so well, I could get across country, you know, with just crossing roads. And that was the thing one had to be careful of, that you didn't get caught as you crossed the road. And they said they would question us pretty closely, you know, as we would have been questioned by the Germans if we were caught.
By the British authorities?
Yes, yes. They would, you know, want to know who you were and what you were and what you were doing. It's fairly difficult to think up an excuse for what you were doing riding a horse at 2 o'clock in the morning.
It's quite a challenge for a young girl. You
were, yes.
What, 16 at the time?
Yeah, went and, you know, people have said, "Weren't you frightened?" I said, "No, it was, in some ways, it was all a game." And then when you thought about it, well, it was your war work, apart from the farm work. And I suppose one was too young to think about, you know, what it might be like if the Germans did come.